Welcome to Short Course, episode 126, for March 8th, 2024. I'm your host, Ben Barry. This week, I want to provide a recap with some context and comments of the February 2024 board meeting, and then wrap up with a small topic related to Production 15. I'm going to try doing this some more, actually having a few topics, not just current events all the time. Because it's stuff I enjoy talking about and I'd like to get back to it. But there are definitely things to cover. And if nothing else, I just wanted to catch up and recap the February board meeting before it's too far in the rear view. I'd hoped to do this last week, but life has just been too busy. So before I start, I just wanted to address something, which is an idea that I was introduced to via an author and a speaker named Marion Tupi. I don't know if this is some other philosopher or ancient source has talked about this before, but it's the idea that, generally speaking, things can get worse very quickly, but they get better very slowly. And this is just a trend almost worldwide. Even when you have some invention that ends up changing the world, it takes a while for it to actually do that, to actually change the world. So things, when they get better, it tends to happen slowly. Now, you can get in a car crash, you can have someone die, you can have a stock market crash, right? When things get bad, they tend to go bad very quickly. But it's very rare that things get a lot better very quickly. And I say that not as an excuse, but just as an observation on the nature of reality and the fact that I do think things are getting better on the board. I do think we're moving in the right direction. They're not moving at the speed that a lot of people in the instant gratification social media age would like, but I do think we're getting there. And in that vein, to set the stage for this meeting, we once again had 6 voting members of the board because we currently have 3 seats of the 9 on the board are vacant. But this was Interim Area 1 Jim Boone's first meeting, and both in this meeting and in interactions with him outside of the meeting, I continue to be very impressed with him. So we had Jim as Area 1, Layton as Area 2, 3, 4, and 5 were vacant. Area 6 was myself, Area 7 is Frank Rizzi, Area 8, Russell Fortney, and Yimin as president. So we're operating it at 2/3 strength, which is not insignificant, especially in terms of trying to divide up the work in front of us. But the meeting started with the process, as I mentioned on a previous episode, that I think we should get to, which is the idea that we vote to approve the minutes and vote to amend the minutes at the subsequent meeting. So in January, we'll have the meeting, we'll approve the minutes from December. In February, we'll approve the minutes from January. And the reason this is important, the reason I suggested this in the first place, now, by no means did I ram this through, but I suggested it to the board, and as I mentioned before, it was accepted without comment. The reason I had suggested this is there were discussions about the way minutes were handled in the past, in particular around whether or not motions were included in the minutes, and their full text, or who had made them, that sort of thing. And in my opinion, when you don't have the minutes be something that is itself a part of the meeting, where people who disagree about what should be in the minutes can have that discussion and then vote, what you end up with is a process where whoever is compiling the minutes basically gets to control what's in them. And that is not the way that boards should be run. That's not the way that Robert's Rules looks at minutes. They are meant to be a collaborative work of the whole board that the board agrees to whatever degree a board can agree to anything, right? I mean, you could still have minutes approved by a 5-4 vote, but that's what's required to pass any given measure. In most cases, there are some measures that obviously require supermajority, but the point being, I still think that there is value in this approach of having the ability to amend the minutes and approve them. I also think there was value in the old way of having the minutes posted quickly after the meeting as a recap for people who, well, at that time, there was no live stream. I don't know where we go from here. I don't know how we find a system that accomplishes both goals well, but I think having the members of the board be able to formally vote and have input on what should go in the minutes is a good thing, and not having run through that process was an expediency that was implemented that is fundamentally undemocratic. Now, that said, as soon as we did vote to approve the minutes, in my view, they should have been posted. There are delays. As of this recording, it's been a week and a half, and they're still not up, but hopefully they'll be up in the next few days. So they are coming, but it is not due to any kind of malice or conspiracy. It's just they're taking a little while to get compiled and posted. The other thing that we did before the live stream started was, based on a discussion internal to the board, we revised the guest policy. So at the beginning of the January board meeting, I suggested and we adopted a two-sentence guest policy, which I mentioned on previous podcasts. And going into this meeting, I think we had agreed that it was important to clarify who was invited as guests and the role of guests. And so the policy that I drafted and sent to the board that we ended up voting to approve says all voting members of the board and the managing director are invited to each meeting. Any non-voting director presenting a report on the agenda is invited as a guest. The president by himself or a majority of the board present may invite any other person as guest. Guests can be recognized by the chair for the purpose of presenting a report or otherwise briefing the board on a topic and for answering questions asked in response to that report. During discussion or debate on a motion, any voting member of the board can request the chair recognize a guest for their input on the topic and to answer questions raised during the discussion. Silent observers are accommodated via the official live stream. So the idea here being just to more clearly delineate the fact that the board is the voting members and the president, and the board meetings, the purpose is for us to have discussions and to call upon guests who are subject matter experts for various purposes, but to make it clear that the power to invite guests lies with the board and the president, and recognizing guests obviously relies solely on the president. The end result of this is the meeting was much more focused on the actual discussion among the board, with asking and seeking input from guests when desired. So the other thing that was somewhat quirky about this meeting, we actually did end up having to split it into two sessions once again. In this case, the Monday night session was only about 2 hours, and that was because Yi Min, as president, he was supposed to be home already. His flight home from Western State Single Stack had been delayed, and apparently they put him on the last flight out, so unless he was going to spend another night in the hotel, we had to end the meeting 2 hours after it began. So we only got through about 2 hours of the agenda, and it was not planned that way, but we were able to accommodate. Again, ideally, we would be in a situation where even having the president as chairman have to drop out of the meeting, if we still had a quorum and, you know, the vice president could lead the meeting as chair, then we would be in good shape. But actually, as it happened, Russell Fortney, who's the vice president, was also traveling back from Western States Single Stack. In his case, he was driving, so he was not in a position to chair the meeting. We could have appointed another chair, but it made more sense to, when we only have 6 votes in the first place, just adjourn the meeting until we could reconvene 2 days later. So I'll kind of leave that out of this, but that was a dynamic there. It was, Yi Min did not schedule the flight at that time. He ended up getting bumped. His plan was to be home by that time to be able to lead the meeting. But stuff happens when you're flying in the US, I suppose. So in that first 2 hour session, we basically went over a bunch of, once we got the live stream going, which again was a unanimous vote in favor of live streaming. Once the live stream was going, we went over the committee policy, which it will not single-handedly save USPSA by itself, but was something relatively important to dispatch with procedurally. The main change being that Yi Min had drafted this committee policy that will also need some bylaws changes to go with it around appointing members to committees. But the general idea was just outlining the notion that committees will have a chair and a vice chair, both of them being elected directors with the goal of having A, a backup, and B, some sense of continuity. So if the chair's term expires, then the vice chair at least has been involved with operations, and there's a path for a handoff there, which I think is smart. I think it's a reasonable policy. And then we just went through and ended up redoing a bunch of committee appointments, in part because when we did them the last time, Mel and Rick Steele, who have since resigned, were on a bunch of committees. And so, for example, the audit committee was now basically vacant. And so we had to appoint an audit committee, in part because the expense policy, not the bylaws, but the policy states that the chair of the audit committee is the one who approves any expenses above the specified spending limits in the expense policies, as well as the fact that we are going to have to, the audit committee is charged with overseeing the annual financial review. So last year was an audit year. We do an audit every 3 years and a financial review where the accountant just looks over our statements and looks for, I suppose, glaring errors. So it's not as in-depth as an audit, but it's still an annual review. And that will be starting up here soon now that 2023 is closed. So we ended up doing a bunch of committee appointments. And the other thing that was relevant is now that Frank is back on the board, he was able to be appointed as chair of the bylaws committee, which was the original plan until he was removed in the January board meeting. He's now been reinstated, so he's back there. I will be assisting as the vice chair, but he'll be leading that. And we have put out the call through the official announcement page looking for people who are interested in helping out with that committee. So if you if you're interested, or if you know someone who you think would be helpful and a good member of the committee, please have them send Frank and I an email at area7 and area6@uspsa.org. That was where the first session wrapped up. We ended up reconvening Wednesday night and picking up from there. The rules changes that we voted on in January are now effective. So the rule books have been updated, and the main changes I think that people really see. So leg straps are now allowed on holsters, which is a variance from IPSC, but I think one that makes sense given our different gun culture in the U.S. versus the more purely sport focused gun ownership regime in basically every other IPSC region. So I think that's a reasonable one if people want to use a leg strap, as long as the holster still complies with the height requirement of the butt of the gun above the top of the belt, then it doesn't really make a difference to me. The other one that I think will make a bit of a difference is we are now measuring distance to the gun from the outside of the belt instead of from the inside of the belt. And this is one of those places where we are also different from IPSC. In IPSC, the measurement is taken from the body. So basically, you know, where even if you got a muffin top or a spare tire, the measurement is taken from that, because what we're looking for is basically clearance between your physical body and the gun. And I believe it's 50 millimeters to the center line of the gun, which obviously is not as exact as the overlay just has to touch the gun. So it's a bit of a different measuring scheme. Is it better? I don't know, but it certainly is different. It definitely gives most people with most double belt setups an extra quarter, 3/8 of an inch to move the belt outwards. So there are definitely a lot of designs that were not viable before, with things like some of these QLS quick detach systems, that kind of thing, that you could probably make work in production and carry optics in limited optics, open, all those where they use the long side of the overlay. That was never really an issue, but that's the other thing to bear in mind, is that rule has changed. There was some discussion of the slot policy for the PCC and mini rifle world shoot. So the world shoot slot committee had just met earlier and had written up the policy and was presenting it. And this was an update. So originally the PCC mini rifle world shoot was going to be in 2024, and it got delayed a year, I believe, just due to logistical reasons, trying to get everything set up. So it will be next year, the same year as the handgun world shoot, which will be in South Africa. The PCC and mini rifle world shoot will be in the Czech Republic. And mini rifle is just semi-auto 22s. So yes, you can shoot a Ruger 10-22, but I think you tend to see a lot more AR pattern 22 rifles. But there are certain countries, I believe the UK is one of them, where civilian ownership of semi-auto rifles is basically legal except for 22s. So in those countries, mini rifle is what sort of passes for their action shooting with long guns. And so this will be the first year that there'll be a mini rifle world shoot. I believe it's also the first year for a PCC world shoot. And it was decided because they are similar, they'll be grouped together. And the policy that was announced is that the matches that will be considered for selection for awarding slots for the US region, so whatever slots that we get, the PCC mini rifle world shoot, which is separate from the rifle world shoot, which is all the center fire rifles that's happening this year, the PCC mini rifle world shoot slots will be distributed based on an aggregate finish of your best three of the last five US PCC nationals, so 2020 through 2024. I brought up on the meeting that PCC was recognized at the 2023 IPSC Nationals, and to me, that seems like a reasonable score to also include, if for no other reason than if somebody were shooting PCC and either wasn't very competitive in 2022 or maybe just recently got into the sport and wasn't even in the sport back then, they would have a tough time qualifying if they only shot 2023 and 2024. I didn't really get a good answer to why the IPSC Nationals, the one that did recognize PCC, was not included, but it wasn't. So that ship has sailed, I suppose. But that is, for those who are interested in the PCC and Mini Rifle World Shoot, that is what was adopted. And we then went into an executive session to discuss finances. And this is one of those spots where the bylaws tie our hands. So bylaw 10.2 says all financial information, employee information, membership lists, and similar matters of this corporation shall remain confidential. The next sentence does say all open session boardroom discussions shall remain confidential until the minutes of those discussions are approved for dissemination by a majority of the board, except and unless otherwise approved by a 3/4 majority of the board. So that second sentence allows for the suspension of that one part of the bylaws, but not for the whole provision of 10.2. So I heard some people saying, well, if they waive 10.2, then there's no confidentiality of anything. And that is not the way the bylaws are worded currently. I don't think that's the way it should be, but that's the way the bylaws are. And, you know, if we just start deciding which bylaws we are and aren't going to follow, then what's the point of having them? So we ended up going into executive session, so the financial information was kept confidential. I will say I don't think it's a violation of confidence to say what we were reviewing was fairly high level. It was mostly a position statement. So just, we have this much money in the last year. We spent this much in these different budget categories, but not necessarily an actual picture of what is being spent on a monthly basis, or even ideally a comparison of in a given month what we had budgeted to spend on each budget category and what we actually did spend. And that's what we are working towards. We have an accounting specialist. I'm not sure his exact title, but he is a contractor who is working with us and helping to work through QuickBooks and get things in order. And so he's helping us get to having those reports ready. But this is one of those places where historically the board would get these reports. Apparently they would be given these, the kind of reports that were being given now, and they would say, okay, sounds good. And nothing else was really requested. So that is what is sort of continuing to be delivered to the board. And we are asking for different things as a board now, which is good. I think that will be necessary for the process of improving the finances, but obviously that doesn't happen overnight. So wheels are in motion on that. There wasn't really that much incendiary or spicy happening in the financials executive session, mostly just looking over what we did have and asking questions about how we could get to information that would more readily help us sort of navigate our way to being able to guide the organization into cutting costs in the appropriate spots. After that, there was an update on, well, semi-update on the opinion from the Delaware law firm about the legality of bylaw 7.7. In particular, under Delaware law, are directors allowed to remove other directors? The agenda item was put on there hoping that we would have the decision back from the law firm. We don't yet. They have written a draft for review by their full committee that basically analyzes these opinions from all different angles and makes sure they're airtight. So when we do eventually get that, whether it's an opinion or a memorandum, whatever the status of that document is, it will be basically as completely reviewed as they can make it, which is good. It's not just one lawyer's opinion, but it is sort of the collective wisdom of the whole firm. So hopefully we'll get a pretty well-rounded perspective on things. But as of now, the Area 3 situation is still basically in limbo pending the return of that report. We did act on the results of the Area 4 interim committee. So Ken Cobb was appointed interim Area 4 while the special election continues. So we're still in the phase until March 30th of people having the opportunity to submit their petitions. At that point, it'll be 45 days until the vote starts, 30 days of voting, and assuming there are more than two candidates, it'll go to a runoff if nobody gets 50% plus one vote of the votes. It'll go to a runoff, which again will be another 45 days of waiting, 30 days of voting, and then we'll actually have a new Area 4 candidate. So in all likelihood, Ken will probably be with us for 5 months or so. I haven't had a chance to talk to him yet, but from the email traffic back and forth, he seems like he'll be a good guy to work with. We also then went through the process of forming a committee to solicit the nominations for interim Area 5. So that won't go to a special election because that seat was up for regular election this year, but we are responsible for appointing an interim for the remainder of 2024, where whoever wins the election, their term will start January 1st, 2025. So that was started. It's Frank, me, and Jim Boone, and the emails have been sent out. We're starting to get names back. So presumably we'll pick a name. We scheduled everything, so we should be able to present someone in time for the March meeting. Again, vote to approve them, set their start date. So hopefully we'll have someone, an interim Area 5 in place by the end of March. And after that, we just wrapped up with another executive session related to the compensation committee presenting their report. Not much to really say about that right now, but just part of the regular employee internal business of the board. So that is the kind of stuff that should remain confidential, I think, going forward. But I'm glad that we were able to live stream everything outside of that so that everyone could see what is happening, the discussions that are happening. And, you know, we are slowly making progress. I will say, especially with the resignation of Rick Steele, Area 5, who'd been on the board, I believe his email said 9 years, something like that. At this point, the board is pretty darn young. Layton is the only person who's been on the board more than about a year at this point. I think Russell was appointed middle of last year. So of the six of us, five have 1 year or less experience on the board, which is good in the sense that we are taking a fresh look at things, revisiting some of the policies, trying to figure out ways to do things better. You know, one of the initiatives is just trying to consolidate all the policies that have been voted on at different points over the years in the minutes and in the various meetings so that we have one handbook policy document to actually review. So we're not having to hunt through a bunch of different documents or through literally years of minutes to find when we voted on something and what the decision was. But that's all. It's happening. It's going slowly. Again, I know it's not the lightning fast turnaround that everyone was hoping for, you know, including things like this opinion taking a while to get back from the Delaware law firm. But I think just bear with us, give us a little while longer. Things are trending in the right direction. And I think momentum is shifting. So just give us a few more, give us a little more time. The topic that I wanted to bring up comes out of the fact that this past weekend I did get to shoot the Sir Walter Gunn Club monthly USPSA match. And this set of stages ended up being, I think, fairly interesting for anyone shooting production 15, which there were, I think, 8 of us. But the stages, for a few different reasons, ended up definitely being a different flavor than if you just had 10. So I actually inadvertently, without thinking about production 15 as a reason, 2 of the 3 stages that I submitted for this month were 14 round stages. One was you had a plate rack with 6 plates and then 2 pieces of paper on either side of the plate racks. You had to move basically from the extreme left to the extreme right of this rectangular shooting area. So it was, you know, 4 feet front to back, but I think 20, 24 feet wide with a couple barrels in the middle that you had to navigate around. So you either had to step forward or step back out of the shooting area just to get around the barrels, and your gun started on the barrel unloaded in the middle. And so you had a sort of natural middle point to the stage where the safe plan was definitely grab the gun, load it, shoot 7. As you're stepping around the barrels, load the second mag, shoot the second 7. And it definitely influenced my decision. You know, some people stepped forward around the barrels. I stepped back. That way I was kind of loading with the gun in front of me. Not any amazing, you know, world-class stage or anything, but it seemed like a reasonably interesting way to take our most restrictive bay there with that plate rack that we can't move and try and make something interesting out of it. But there was definitely a sort of natural choice there where do you want to try and go 1-for-1 on the steel and shoot a 14 round stage where with production 15, you've got 15 in the gun because it's an unloaded start, or do you want to stick that load in the middle? And then the other stage was originally going to be a 12 round short course, but I had to stick a 7th paper target in there because I was using the rule that lets you specify that the last up to 6 shots of the stage may be specified to be taken one-handed. In this case, I only was mandating the last 2 targets, 4 shots, be taken strong hand only, mostly because I think that rule is underused. I think that style of, you know, as freestyle one-handed shooting where you can actually take makeups, it's a Comstock stage where you can move around, it's not box to box, Virginia count, fixed time, one-handed shooting. I think that rule is underused, and so I wanted to build a stage that used it, but the rule book says it has to be at least a medium course, so medium or long. And so that meant taking the 12 rounder, slapping in another target to make it a medium course. And that one was a little more straightforward because you started loaded, so you had 16 rounds to shoot a 14 round stage. So there wasn't a ton of risk. The targets were not particularly far. They were all open paper. So it wasn't a super risky plan, but it was one of those where if something had gone wrong, you've only got 2 makeup shots. And so you have to make sure to use them carefully. And especially with shooting one-handed, if you yank a shot or something like that, because it's a Comstock stage, you can make it up, but you have to be mindful of how many makeups you do have. Where, you know, let's say it were a 14 round Virginia count stage, well, capacity doesn't really matter because if you're shooting makeups, you're screwed anyway. So I thought those 2 14 round stages, again, completely inadvertently, not consciously designed for any production 15 reasons, were interesting to shoot in that context. And then there were a number of the other stages that have a round count between, say, 22 and 28, I think is a really interesting number in a world where you have 15 rounds in the gun. And that's because anywhere in that kind of 22 to 28 range, you most of the stages will basically present the option to do 1 reload somewhere in the middle of the stage. So shoot 12 to 14 rounds, stick a reload, shoot the other 12 to 14 rounds, or shoot 4 to 6, stick your first reload, shoot 10 to 14, stick a second reload, shoot 4 to 6. And so there was one stage in particular, stage 8, at this match, which you can see in my match video, where I looked at it both ways, and I basically just made the call that I thought the best way to do it was to stick a one-step reload, basically moving from one position, turning the gun to the next spot, and just stick the load and do one of them. And it ended up being, I think it was 12 and 12 before and after the reload, or 12 and 14, something like that. And to me, that's that actually, if you have stage designers that design in that 24 to 28 range, that actually makes for interesting stages in a 15 round world. Now, yes, if you've got a 32 round stage, then yeah, everybody's going to have to reload twice. If you've got a 32 round stage where it's four positions of eight rounds each, then you should maybe ask the match director if he would like help designing better stages. But yeah, obviously in that case, if it's a hard 8-8-8-8 stage, yeah, maybe you're going to do more reloads. But in most cases, when you get below that 28 round scenario, you can, I think, have some really interesting stages. Now, obviously a 24 round stage with the guys with 140 millimeter magazines, a lot of them are going to do the cool guy thing where they Barney up and maybe they use their 25 rounder and they shoot the whole thing with no reload. Or if it's a 26 rounder, they're just going to reload somewhere, but they could do it after the first target or two. So there isn't really a lot of sort of strategy or skill because they can just reload wherever's the most convenient in the stage. But in that sort of 22 to 28 range, I just noticed at this match, there were a couple of interesting stages where on some of them, it did make sense to shoot the, you know, 4 to 6 rounds, do a reload and, you know, reload again a second time towards the end of the stage. But then there were other times where it did make sense just to really nail that one fast reload in the middle of the stage. And I thought that was an interesting choice. So obviously I've been on the Production 15 train for a while. Now that it's here, I'm digging it. I still think it would be cool to have a production optics division that was more production-y guns with a 15 round capacity. I think the 15 round capacity makes for interesting stages in a way that 24 round 140 millimeter mags doesn't, but that's just, you know, my personal feeling. So I'll have the match video for that linked. Note my shooting was terrible. I've not been dry firing, but the stages were interesting, and it was also a wake up call. So the South Carolina section match is now it's a week and a half away, but at the time it was 2 weeks away. So I did actually get out and start dry firing for the year this week, which is not as early as I'd wished it would be, but obviously life has been busy, so I haven't been able to spend as much time doing that as I would like. But my hope is to do moderately competent at South Carolina section. So that wraps up this episode of Short Course. If you want to get in touch with me, my email is ben@berryshooting.com. Talk to you next time.